Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. If you've been listening along to the past few episodes, then you know that we are going through a spooky phase leading up to Halloween. I'm enjoying it. I don't want it to end. I know it can't last forever, but we've got another good one today. We've got a two-part episode. Check this out, Noel, super producer Casey Pegram. We figured this one out in advance. I'm Ben.
Yeah, it's in the spirit of Halloween, Ben. I figured that we would be doing a disservice to the listener if we didn't demarcate these two-parters ahead of time. And this one, it is worthy of such, and we know exactly where we're going to break it. Oh my God, I've got shivers running down my spine just thinking about it.
This has never happened.
Maybe once?
No, I don't think so. No, I think it's a different show. We've said that we figured out something was going to be a two-parter in advance a couple of times.
Right.
But then we've leaned on Casey. And again, thank you, Casey. We've been like, I don't know. Casey will figure it out.
He'll figure it out. Super producer Casey Pegram. And when you say another show, you don't mean like somebody else's show. You mean like it's one of the other shows that we do, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool. What do you think about this momentous occasion, super producer Casey Pegram?
We're entering a brand new era. And, I'm excited to see where it takes us.
Well, you also, knowing our luck, dear Ridiculous Historians, please forgive us if this accidentally ends up being a three-parter. How hilarious would that be? But we think we've got it figured out, and we think this is something that's got a little bit of Law and Order. It's got some murder, some mystery, some spookiness.
Yeah.
Noel, how could a young, otherwise healthy woman drop dead of a everlasting faint?
The Everlasting Faint. That's my favorite emo band from the early aughts, by the way. The Everlasting Faint.
I thought it was like a good classic greatest hits album name for the faint.
That's very true. That's very true. There also was a latter day smash. I guess we're still in the latter days of the Smashing Pumpkins. I do wish they'd stop, but they are coming back with a huge Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness 25th anniversary, by the way. Anybody else feel old? I sure do. But anyway, they had a song off of their album, Machina, the Machines of God, called The Everlasting Gaze. But not the same thing as an everlasting faint. I think the everlasting gaze might be like a stroke. The everlasting faint is a heart attack, or at least in the parlance of the time, which would be 1897.
Yes. Oh, real quick, nothing to do with anything while we're shouting out anniversaries. I just learned that today, this very day that we're recording this, is the 11-year anniversary of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, Noel.
Is that right?
Yeah, we totally missed it because we peeked behind the curtain. We recorded that show earlier today.
Well, I guess turnabout being fair play and all, now we just have to wait till the 11th anniversary of Ridiculous History and forget to shout that out on this show and shout it out on the other show. And then
there
the loop will be closed.
Perfect.
But the year is 1897, Greenbrier County, West Virginia. Mary Jane Heaster. Oh boy, people might come at us for the pronunciation here. It's H-E-A-S-T-E-R. I really don't think, I mean, it wouldn't be Heaster. I think Heaster. Hester? Hester seemed a little more of the time, but I guess I'm just thinking of the Crucible. Or no, I'm sorry, not the Crucible, the Scarlet Letter, excuse me.
Let's go with Heaster.
Heaster is good. We're going to go with Mary Jane Heaster of Greenbrier County, West Virginia. Is sound asleep. It's winter. It's cold. She's bundled up. She's still in mourning from, you know, I'm editorializing here a bit, but likely from the late January death of her newly wedded daughter, Zona, which is a name that I absolutely love. So she's asleep and she has this vision. She has this dream vision. An apparition appears to her and it's Zona's ghost telling her how it was that she came to die.
Right. That's our setup because she's haunted by that question that I asked at the top. You know, she's Mary Jane is not a doctor, but she is a person with common sense and she's thinking, a healthy person. That's so odd that she would drop dead of a heart attack. That's what the everlasting faint was that the doctor had written in the autopsy report and his findings. And when she sees what she believes to be the apparition of her deceased daughter, Zona brings her a message. At least that's what Mary Jane believes. And Zona is telling her mother it was not an everlasting faint. It was not a heart attack. It was homicide. It was murder most foul. And this event leads us to what remains one of the most unique court cases in human history. To get into the details about how weird this series of events becomes, I think maybe it's good for us to start in a happier place. You know, who doesn't love a wedding? We can throw some rom-com in here. There's a bit of a meet-cute story that happens a year earlier in the summer of 1896. With another really cool name, by the way.
Oh, so many cool names in the story. And by the way, we'll go ahead and put it out there if you didn't see it in the metadata. This is the story of the Greenbrier ghost. So, summer, 1896. A gentleman by the name of Erasmus Stribling Shoe, fantastic name, moved from a place called Droop Mountain, another amazing name for a place that was probably only somewhat amazing, in Pocahontas County, it just doesn't stop, in West Virginia. And he picked up and moved to Livesay's Mill in Greenbrier County. Erasmus being a handsome gentleman, strong of feature, muscular of arm, leg, one would assume as well. He had taken a job at a blacksmith shop, owned by one James Crookshank. Erasmus would intro himself to folks as Edward. People knew him by the name of Trout, which, you know, you could either think is charming or sort of like a prison nickname. No spoilers quite yet, but we're leaning already kind of towards the second one of those two options.
Well, I want to be completely fair to speak from experience in West Virginia, Eastern Tennessee areas of the U.S. like this. It is very much common. It's a common thing for people to have somewhat anomalous nicknames that are used in place of their names on their birth certificate, if they had one. And it's also common for people to have names that aren't super common in the rest of the country. I'm saying this as a guy who has a great aunt whose name was literally Nine.
Nice.
Can you guess why? It's not hard.
She
was the ninth kid.
Ninth kid. Did you ever see that show Ozark on Netflix?
Yeah.
Very good. But you know, there's like a kind of a country family, a sort of a clan that lives out in kind of like a rural part of the whole place is rural. They live in like a trailer situation. And one of the kids' name is Six, I think, which that's sort of, okay, that holds true.
I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, I think it's cool too.
I have I think they're related to me. They live in the same town, but I know I've met someone named Seven as well.
Got it.
I don't know if they were the seventh kid or if their parents were just like, that is the winning number.
Seven's cool. Seven's one of my favorite Prince songs, by the way. Underappreciated from the New Power Generation era. Check it out if you haven't heard it already.
So back to Trout. Shortly after Erasmus gets to Livesay's Mill, he meets a farmer's daughter. Casey, we get to have a little bit of rom-com music here. It'd be beautiful.
Slap some Seinfeld bass, perhaps? No, I don't know. Who knows what Casey will come up with? It'll be great. Whatever it is, it's happening right now, and I love it.
Yeah, I think you've outdone yourself, Casey. By the way, every time I say something like that, I'm sure I'm annoying you, Casey, because we don't know what you're coming up with. Anyway, so as I was saying, so Trout meets a farmer's daughter. Cue the music. Her name is Elva Zona Heaster. Zona is head over heels with Trout. She's smitten. She's over the moon. This handsome man, she's thinking. And he is feeling the same way. This is completely reciprocated. So they courted for a short while. That's, you know, dating. And then they were married very soon after meeting. October 20th. 1896, almost 124 years to today, right? We just passed the anniversary of their meeting, their marriage. She was 23 when she met Trout, and he was 37. So a little bit of age difference there, but nothing, you know, particularly scandalous. Mary Jane, however, the mother, remember, she was not a fan of Erasmus or Trout. She wasn't on board with the marriage. But love, like life, finds a way, as Jeff Goldblum would say. So the pair settles down into a house right near that blacksmith shop. Fast forward 3 months, as we set up at the top, January 23rd, Zona has passed away.
Yeah, so here's how that came to pass, or at least, you know, how I've got to tell you, I've been watching the first season of the incredible FX series Fargo, written and created by Noah Hawley, who also did that show Legion, which is fantastic. And he's done a bunch of other really cool stuff and has written some books, really talented dude. But it's the first season's all about murder most foul and trying to cover it up and all of the lengths that you go to make people think that a certain chain of events happened. I can't help it. My mind can't help but go there in the intention that Trout went to, the very specific order of operations that he went to lead to discovery of his beloved's body. So on January 23rd, 1897, Trout went and paid a visit to Martha Jones, a.k.a. Auntie Martha, and he asked her son, Anderson, if he could go to his house to get some eggs and to see if Zora needed anything, because she was feeling poorly, which is something they would have said in 1897. Once he was inside, this kid came upon a horror show. Zora's lifeless body at the foot of the stairs, face down. You know, from the look of it, she'd taken a nasty tumble down those stairs. Her legs were straight. Her arms were stretched out. She had one of her arms was stretched out. Her other arm was tucked under her chest, and her head was kind of at a little bit of a canted angle. He even had a moment, poor kid, where he thought maybe she was like asleep, and he stepped towards her, you know, calling her name. Mrs. Shue, he said, and nothing. So he freaked out, as any kid discovering such a thing would likely do. And he took off, ran to his mom's house, where he reported this tragedy that he had stumbled upon, at which point they called the doctor, who was also the coroner, one George W. Knapp.
And by the time the doctor has arrived, Trout Shue Erasmus, take him with that name, has already returned home. He's carried his former spouse's body up to a bedroom. He's washed and dressed her and laid her on the bed. This is interesting because Victorian custom held that female family and friends should wash and dress the deceased. But Erasmus did it himself for reasons that we'll explore later. He had prepared her body for burial. He put her in a nice dress. It was, importantly, a high-necked dress with a stiff collar. He put a veil over her face. And as the doctor, remember this detail, folks, as the doctor, Knapp, is examining the corpse, Shue is cradling his wife's head, if you can picture it, and he is crying, sobbing inconsolably the whole time, which makes sense. He has just lost his wife. An interesting thing happens, though. In the course of his examination, the doctor says, you know, he starts moving toward Elver Zona's neck and head, and this irritates the bejesus out of Trout. And Knapp goes, okay, you know, I understand this is, I can't even begin to imagine what a terrible, harrowing time this is for you. So I'm going to leave it at that. I have, in my examination, found nothing wrong with anything about Elva physically, other than, of course, the fact that she is dead.
Yeah.
and I'd also been treating her, you know, as the town doctor for a few weeks beforehand. So I'm going to call this cause of death a heart attack, a faint that lasts forever.
Yeah. I hope he was a better doctor than he was a coroner. I tell you, this makes my mind go right back to Fargo, because there's all these like hapless Minnesota cops that are just like, oh, don't mess with the poor man. He's been through so much. Don't ask him any more questions. You know, it's the same kind of deal here. It's that small town kind of mentality, and the idea that no one would ever do anything untoward, you know, let alone, you know, murder most foul. So this kind of odd behavior extends to the funeral. Elva's body is taken. And just a quick housekeeping note. We've been sometimes referring to this young woman as Elva, sometimes Zona. She was referred to that interchangeably by her friends, I believe. And then also a lot of the reporting that we found interchanges those names too. So not to confuse anybody. Ben, you want to stick with one? Which one do you like better? I'm a big fan of Zona.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Zona, but the reason I said Elva Zona a few minutes ago is just to establish that is her full name.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm going to stick with Zona moving forward. So her body is taken to her childhood home of Little Sewell Mountain, which sounds very charming, and she's buried after this weird funeral where Trout acts like a total sketchy weirdo.
This is ridiculous.
More of the neck stuff. More of the cradling, fiddling, you know, messing around with her body as it's laying in state, you know, fiddling with her collar, making sure it's pulled up high enough.
Putting too much stuff on her, like putting a suspicious amount of stuff on her neck and her head.
I found this beloved scarf that dear Zona loved so well. And I'm sorry, I must have forgotten to put it on her when I very hastily dressed her for burial myself. So yeah, let's just wrap it on. Let's shove it on there right in the coffin.
Right. And the family and friends are going, you know, I know it's a tough time for you, Trout, but this is the last time any of us are going to see Zona, and this scarf doesn't match her burial dress. And so Shu turns on the wetworks again and he says, well, this is her favorite scarf. She would have wanted to be buried in it. And then while he's doing this, he's like also propping her head up incrementally, first with a pillow, then a rolled up cloth. I got to tell you this. Okay. So I just rewatched Death Becomes Her. You guys remember Death Becomes Her?
Oh yeah. With the make where as they start decomposing, they start mm-hmm. having to lay on the makeup thicker and then like the head right. will crack or something. And they have to like touch it up real quick. Oh, nothing to see here. Definitely exactly. not dead. You know? Yeah.
This reminds me of that. Death Becomes Her, by the way, is a wonderful campy romp and holds
it's
up
so good
if you want a Halloween movie but you don't want to be too scared.
It's definitely not for the kiddos, but you're right, Ben. It's got some good effects, good makeup effects. It reminds me of like a Tim Burton movie that Tim Burton wished he had made. You know what I mean? Like it's got that vibe to it, and I love Bruce Willis playing kind of a chump. He's usually such this like badass kind of like leading man action star. And in this one, he's a total sucker kind of, what's the word? Like a patsy almost, you know, he was totally taken advantage of by these strong-willed women.
He's the character who has a redemptive arc though. No
he does.
Spoilers.
No, he does. Exactly.
He does have the happy ending.
For sure.
But I mean, it's a slapstick for the ages. I wouldn't be surprised if it was originally written for the stage. Everybody at the funeral is in kind of an awkward, curb your enthusiasm, peep show level position because they're like, that's weird, right? They're looking at each other and like, he's messing with her neck a lot.
Yeah.
And like, well, he's grieving, you know? People express grief in a multitude of ways. So we've just got to help him out.
It's what I like to call pathological politeness. You know what I mean? Where it's sort of like you want so much not to upset anybody that you just ignore huge red flags or just don't want to call out when something is very, very, very wrong to the detriment of all concerned.
Which again, shout out to Peep Show. There is one person though who rejects this social convention, and that is Elva Zona's mother, Mary Jane.
That's who we were talking about at the very top of the show, slipping into that deep sleep.
Mm-hmm. And she already, like, it's public knowledge that her son-in-law is never going to win the Mary Jane Heister Award for My Favorite Person. But she couldn't quite put her finger on it. There was something off about the dude, something she didn't cotton to. And Zona, she was very close to Elva Zona. That was not only her only daughter, but also functionally her best friend. And so she felt kind of abandoned when Zona had moved to Livesay's mill on the other side of the county. And maybe it was just a mother's intuition, which I rarely chalk things up to, but she had this feeling. She had a certitude that this guy, Trout, had something to do with her daughter's death. You know what I mean? She's watching him futz with the neck.
Oh, big time. And okay. And so, you know, being a woman of God, she decided to pray on it. And she did. She prayed for nights and nights and nights and nights that her daughter would somehow give her a sign from the great beyond as to what really happened. Or at the very least, you know, give her a little closure and say goodbye. Because at the, you know, on the most basic level, she didn't buy the heart attack story. She didn't really necessarily hadn't really keyed in on anything else or any specific foul play, but she knew that didn't make any sense. So according to Mary Jane herself, she prayed on this relentlessly for multiple nights. And then that one night that we set up at the very top of the show in 1897, just after when her daughter was laid to rest, she saw a strange light kind of enter into her view. Was she asleep? Was she awake? She wasn't really sure, but what she did know was that she then saw her daughter's form appear to her and begin to tell a very interesting and upsetting story.
Yes. Mary Jane claimed that her daughter appeared to her in a dream not once, but four separate times, four consecutive nights, to tell her story. And the story she told was grisly, disturbing, and tragic. She would appear as that bright light, assume a human form, and the room would fall into a chill. So Elva Zona's ghost told her mother that Erasmus, or Trout, had abused her severely, and that one night, in a rage, he attacked her because, get this, he thought she hadn't made any meat for dinner, because she served, reportedly, apple butter, a spread of preserves, and bread. And so in that rage, the ghost says, he had broken her neck and her head had turned, Death Becomes Her style, completely around, or Exorcist style. Pick your favorite of the Halloween films there.
Yes, that's exactly right. And by the way, Ben, I do love a good apple butter. I know it's not for everybody, but I certainly wouldn't, you know, break somebody's neck over serving me apple butter. How do you feel about the preserve?
I love preserves. I'm good with a good apple butter. I'm a seasonal person myself. I've never been so moved by rage at food that I would break someone's neck or even punch them. I might have in a show of joy. I may have kissed someone or like loudly oppa clapped in the air or something if there's something I love. But that's horrible. And then didn't she say it's not the first time he had abused her?
Well, yeah. In subsequent nights, she kind of piecemealed the full picture together of the real story, and she did reveal that her husband had often abused her and beaten her and treated her absolutely horribly, that he had a nightmarishly foul temper, and that she was essentially living in fear of him. And he was a completely, you know, unreasonable person that she couldn't talk down once he got into these rages. And again, this is all from Mary Jane's own recollection. Zona apparently went on to tell her about the neighborhood, because again, she didn't live there in the same town as her mom anymore. She'd moved out on her own. And even though we described it as just being on the other side of the county, you know, in these days, in a rural place like this, they would have been a significant distance.
Yeah. And after it would tell an installment of the story, the ghost would vanish. The interesting thing here, and something that's different from a lot of regional folk tales of ghostly revenge or something, the interesting thing here is that this ghost is very specific on how her neck was broken. She says that Trout snapped it at the first joint, and first he squeezed for some time and then snapped it. And then, as if to really drive the point home, Mary Jane according to her testimony on the final and fourth night, watched as Zona's ghost twisted her head around 180 degrees to show just how severely broken her neck was.
These are terrifying visions, Ben, especially if your beloved late daughter to be showing you such sights, as they say, such things to show you. But this was, you know, in her mind, just what she'd been asking for in her prayers. And she took this information, if we could call it that, and went to the local prosecutor, a gentleman by the name of John Preston over in Lewisburg. And she spent an entire afternoon trying to explain the story to him and convincing him to open up the case again.
Yeah. And to this point, still in 2020, we do not know whether Prosecutor Preston believed Mary Jane's story, but she was incredibly tenacious and persistent and again, certain. She began to convince him that regardless of whether or not he believed in ghosts, she was definitely not lying. She was being sincere. So he went around town and started asking some questions. And that's when Preston starts putting together some puzzle pieces. Boy, this guy was sure strange when the doctor examined his dead spouse. Boy, he was even stranger at the funeral. And hey, wait, Dr. Knapp, upon, you know, focused questioning, says, well, my examination was, I guess I would call it 80%, but not 100%.
Yeah, he thinks back on that detail of Trout getting agitated when he was making his way up to the neck area, and he literally says something to the effect of, huh, well, you mention it, the husband wouldn't let me examine her neck. You don't suppose that might be suspicious, do you?
Dun, dun.
Bless your little heart, Dr. Knapp.
I pictured like a Mr. Magoo-esque, you know, like good-hearted guy, country doctor. But this, you're right. You're right. Well, it's an interesting character. It's like, huh, yeah. Well, why don't you mention it? Necks are important. I am a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird. Anyway, you want some apple butter?
Yeah, a little apple butter. Fresh and, country apple butter.
Right. And this admission, not this apple butter, this admission was enough for the prosecutor to say, okay, we need to order a complete autopsy. I can justify this because now I'm not saying I'm ordering this because somebody believes in a ghost. I'm saying it because the doctor says they didn't get a chance to do an adequate autopsy.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's certainly not a pleasant thing to have your loved one exhumed, you know, for a second autopsy. But again, it was the mother that was asking for it. So it's not like anyone would have made a fuss about it other than her. We don't really hear about any other family of hers to speak of. Although I imagine the deceased's former husband probably wouldn't have been too pleased about this news.
Oh, he was steamed. He was livid. This is already a guy who has a temper problem, right? So he is doubling down. The Greenbrier Independent, you can read part of this on AppalachianHistory.net. The Greenbrier Independent says that Erasmus, quote, vigorously complained, but then eventually the authorities said, look, son, you can have all the problems you want, but if you don't go to this inquest willingly, we're going to force you to go. So by hook or by crook, your choice. And he said, look, I know you all are going to arrest me, but they will not be able to prove I did it.
Whoops.
I know.
What a dumbass. Not clever, Erasmus. You know what I keep thinking? I forgot to say this out loud. Erasmus, irascible.
Ah, yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
Doesn't that mean kind of grouchy or like a little bit cantankerous?
It means being easily angered, so yeah. It's quite apt.
Okay. It's spelled differently. It's with an I, if I'm not mistaken, but still,
you're correct.
I'm with it. So he basically played himself, as the kids would say. And he was right, though. This wasn't like the age of forensics, you know, where they could tie him to the crime scene with like, you know, DNA samples. It was all circumstantial, all of this stuff. But the findings were a real bad look for our boy Erasmus Trout Shoe.
Yeah. So Knapp and two other doctors lay out the corpse in the schoolhouse of the town. I know this sounds like a very strange place to put a corpse, but in Appalachia at the time, in very small towns, this sort of stuff was not uncommon. Many structures were multi-use, aside from maybe the local church. And they give it a 100% examination. The Pocahontas Times later reports on this autopsy that you're describing, Noel, and it is worse than bad. It is what Orwell would call double plus ungood for Shu. They say the discovery was made that the neck was broken and the windpipe mashed. On the throat were the marks of fingers, indicating that she had been choking. That's their word.
Also like mashed. I think that's a very creative wording there.
It's true that the neck was dislocated between the first and second vertebrae. Remember what the ghost said, and that the ligaments were torn and ruptured. The windpipe had been crushed at a point in front of the neck. This is all exactly what Mary Jane was saying the ghost of her daughter told her.
But like Shu, you know, was saying, Trout, there was really no evidence. All of this was circumstantial. Nothing specifically tying him to the murder, even though people recalled his strange behavior, and it certainly stuck around in that prosecutor's mind, too. And it did cast a little bit of suspicion on him, but it was pretty interesting that Elva's mother, Elva Zona's mother, was able to describe the murder with such graphic detail, so it almost made her a bit of a suspect.
That's a really good point, yeah. Because who else would have this information, right? Curiouser and curiouser.
And there was even a sense that perhaps she was just making up this ghost story in an effort to frame Shu. Because, you know, I mean, this wasn't, it's not like superstition ran amok, but it was a time where I think it would be a little easier to swallow a story like this than maybe in a court of law today.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're not quite into the 20th century. People have a much closer and more immediate relationship with folklore, right? With haints, with Will-o'-the-Wisp and so on.
So Ben, was it Trout? Was it perhaps her own mother that put an end to the young life of Elva Zona Hairston? Nay, Shu. I forget. I'm trying. Now I'm speaking like a late 1800s newspaperman. Well, you're going to have to wait till the next episode to find out. Da-dum-dum.
This concludes part one of the Greenbrier Ghost. We've given you the blow-by-blow, not a pun, not an intentional pun, but we've given you the step-by-step order of events. Let's call this the setup. We have ghosts, we have crime, we have a mystery afoot, and we hope that you join us on what will probably be a Thursday. Not to predict the future, but we'll probably be a Thursday for part two of the Greenbrier Ghost when we add some strange, extraordinary plot twist to the mix. We haven't even gotten to court yet. We can't wait to explore what happens next with you in part two of our episode.
And you might even get a little dramatic courtroom reenactment. I can neither confirm nor deny that that's going to happen, but it's certainly not off the table. In the meantime, thank you so much, Super Producer Casey Pegram, for being our partner in crime or crime solving, spooky crime solving. Well, whatever. Thanks, Case.
Oh, I've got nickname list.
Ah, yes.
Super Producer Casey Cadaver Pegram.
Oh, love it.
Loving it.
I am still Noel Satan Brown because my middle name is actually Christian, so it's still kind of a pun.
It's embarrassing. I made a big ass list of these. So I had Noel Nosferatu Brown.
Love it. I'll tell you, you can have multiple nicknames.
It's, yeah, some, of course.
It's, yeah. What about you, Ben? You've got this policy, though, of not nicknaming yourself, and I feel woefully underprepared.
Ben Bonesaw Bolin.
Love that. Oh, that's good.
Or I'm trying to think of an actual monster. Bonesaws are just grisly. Well, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. Thanks, of course, to Alex Will-O-The-Wisp Williams. Let's see. Thanks to Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, a.k.a. the... what do you think for him?
How about the Ripper?
Yeah.
The Ripster?
The Ripster?
Yeah, that works.
There we go.
I got one for you. Christopher Unleash the Kraken Hasiotis.
Dope. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's going to be big for him. That's going to be big for him in 2021, too.
I hope so. Oh, man, 2021. I can't wait, guys. You think you're just going to magically turn around on day one? All of the stink of 2020 is just going to be like washed away like tears in the rain.
My fear, candidly, is that we may well find ourselves in 2021 looking back on 2020 as not that bad.
Oh, fun. Well, right. Good thing we got some fun, entertaining Halloween content to keep your spirits up or down or what have you. By the way, check out our buddy Matt Frederick's amazing show, 13 Days of Halloween, available now wherever you get podcasts. It's 3D binaural audio spooky storytelling experience with a couple of real chillers written by you, Ben Bolin of Ridiculous History.
Wow, thank you. Oh, yeah, Matt has done amazing work on this. Now Casey, Noel, and I can say that we're technically co-workers with Keegan-Michael Key from Key and Peele.
Yep, who was in the first season of Fargo, by the way, only in the last stretch of it. Full circle.
You were doing so much for Fargo, man. I wish they appreciated you.
I just think it's genius. I missed it the first time around. I saw the second season, and I adored it, and I'd never watched the first season, and Billy Bob Thornton's character in that series... unreal.
Love it.
Unbelievably malevolent. One of the best, like, would you call his character chaotic evil, Ben? Because he just wants to, like, watch the world burn and laugh at it. It's all for his own amusement.
I would. He's, like, a bit more of a restrained Judge Holden from Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, which James Franco keeps saying he's going to adapt. Sorry, story for another day. We want to hear your spooky nicknames. A lot of our best ideas come from you, Ridiculous Historians. So tell us about them on the internet. You can find us. We love to point to Ridiculous Historians, our Facebook page, where you can meet your fellow listeners, aka our favorite part of the show. You can also find us as individuals, if you so please.
You may. I am at How Now Noel Brown on Instagram, and I don't really mess with Twitter much, but I've been using it to keep up with things, but I don't really post. I'm more of a visual learner and expressor. How about you, Ben?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram as at Ben Bolin, and I'm on Twitter as at Ben Bolin HSW. So there you can read my Jack Handy style deep thoughts, like maybe I should have paid all those Blockbuster fees. With late fees, would the world be a different place? I don't know.
It's a good question, Ben. One that we all should be pondering. And until next time, ponder away. We'll see you then. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.